Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Hi, this is Stephen O'Doherty. The Syrian Civil War. It began as a brutal response to the Arab Spring uprisings. How it will end is one of the most open-ended and important questions facing our world today. The UN estimates of the death toll in Syria stand at just under 500,000. Millions more have fled or been internally displaced. Many of those are in camps in the Bekaa Valley, which is across the border from Syria in Lebanon. But even in the midst of all of this, there are stories of hope. Mike Gore is the CEO at Open Doors Australia. That's one of many Christian organisations providing humanitarian relief for all comers in the refugee camps. Fresh from his most recent visit to the camps, I asked Mike Gore, what are the people there going through?
Yeah, look, it's quite unbelievable, to tell you the truth. There's a range of emotion being expressed in the camps. There's just brokenness, but there's also heartache and stress, and then there's, you know, mental health issues because of the loss of income and just instability. It really is quite a depressing place to be.
So to give us a picture, it's almost impossible, of course, from our Australian perspective to understand what life was like in Syria, let alone what life is like for a family that then flees Syria and ends up in a camp. What sorts of families are they? Where do they come from? What did they do before they left?
So in the Bekaa Valley, there's about 500,000 refugees. Many of them came from the kind of Damascus areas in Syria, Aleppo, Homs, those kind of places. And the crazy thing for me is that meeting with these families and sitting down with them, you hear their backstories, and they're professionals. You know, they were doctors, they were pharmacists, lawyers, farmers. They weren't people who didn't have a life as such. You know, I heard story after story of absolute professionals who have now been living in these camps for, some of them, 5 years.
Mm. And what are they telling you about why they left? Why do they have to leave?
And again, it ranges greatly. There's some people who had, you know, face-to-face encounters with ISIS, also the Syrian Free Army and al-Nusra, because part of the story we don't hear is that there's more than just ISIS in Syria at the moment. There's several groups that are terrorizing people. You know, I remember meeting or sitting opposite one family who told me how this woman had three of her brothers killed in front of her very eyes. And then on the same day in her village, they had a funeral for 22 people. It's a Muslim family. One of the things, again, just a caveat, is we often look at ISIS as just Muslim. It's really a Sunni and Shia battle. So there are many Muslims who are victims in this as well. And so she said there was a funeral for 22 of her village in one day. And as she turned around at the end of the funeral, in this occasion, the Syrian Free Army shelled her house to the ground and torched her farm. And that was 5 years ago, when her family then had to walk on foot to the camp that they're now living in. And so it ranges greatly. There's people who are hearing that a group is coming, and so they'll flee, trying to get out of there before that with their children. There are people who wake up and see them face to face. It's just a massive scale of reasons, I guess, why people are there.
So there are three different types of religious groupings that are being targeted by the regime?
Many, many more, actually. There's all sorts of different types of Muslim within Islam. So there's what's called the Druze, D-R-U-Z-E. There are the Sunni and the Shia, then there's Christians and there's Catholics and there's Orthodox. There's all sorts of people that are affected by this. And what it is, and I think for me the real clarifying point is that I'm so often feeling in the West as though we're saying this is a Muslim versus everything else in the world thing. No, that's not the case. It's a terrorist group or terrorist groups versus many religions, including Muslim.
Mike, what is Open Doors, your organisation, doing in these camps?
Great question, Stephen. And so one of the things that we've been doing in these camps at the moment is really working with the initial displacement. What we do as a ministry is that we work with the local church on the ground. So rather than being seen and being really public, we're largely unseen. But the reason we are, or the reason we like to operate that way, is because we love to enable the local indigenous church to do what it does best, and that's to be the hands and feet of Christ to people in some of the most conflicted countries on the planet. And so we're providing aid and relief, winterization packs. One of the camps I was in, you know, it gets to minus 11 in winter. And these are families living in nothing more than tents. We're providing Bibles and church settings for Christians. We're providing training and trying to find employment placement for people. You know, there's such a massive range of things that we're doing down in that area of the world.
Where can they get employment if they're living in camps?
So in local towns and communities, these camps rise up in cities in Lebanon. The influx of people means that there's no way they can survive. There's no way they can live on handouts. They need to try and find work. Now, the flip side to that is that locals in Lebanon will feel quite stressed by this, because what happens is when business providers find cheap labour coming in, it lowers the rate of work, because Syrian refugees are looking for anything they can get and desperately need it to be able to provide for their family. But then the local Lebanese community is saying, well, hang on, you know, the farmer that I was working for is now paying the half rate because so many refugees want it. And again, it's this consistent and constant battle between trying to find employment, but also the impact this has on the Lebanese economy.
The long-term impact in Europe itself, or in the Balkans in Europe, is going to be massive. And you've said, made the point in conversations we've had in the past, this is the largest people movement due to conflict after the Second World War.
Yeah, well, to give you some idea, I mean, some really recent UN statistics, and when I say recent, I mean a couple of weeks old, is that there's 4.9 million Syrian refugees in the surrounding countries.
Okay, goodness.
About 1 million refugees have been able to make it to the so-called West as such. And now within Syria, there are 7 million more displaced internally within their own country. And considering Syria has an overall population of approximately 22 million, that means that more than half of that nation is currently living as either an internally displaced person or a refugee.
Do we have any picture of what that looks like long or even medium term? If the conflict ends, and that's a big if, and if there's a regime change, and that's a big if, what does it look like to even try to put that back together?
And that's, you know, in a westernised sense, and it's something that racks my brain every time I travel to this region, is we seem to be wired to want to solve the problem, or I am anyway. And the more I get into it, the more I understand it, you know, I'm kind of, other than prayer, I honestly don't know what the answer is, because any time I project forward, even a decade or two, thinking about the restoration of even banking services, then you got hygiene, water. You know, we heard of a city in Syria that didn't have running water for 35 days.
Gosh.
I mean, how do people live with that?
I've no idea.
And then people were saying they were capturing water dripping off their air conditioner and trying to boil that to drink. So the condensation was one way that they're trying to survive. And so I look forward and I think to myself, honestly, when I look at it in a big picture sense, there's no foreseeable or even practical solution to it. But what I come back to is that when we can even help just one person, it makes a difference for that one person. I can't help everyone.
No.
But as an organisation, for all the other organisations doing great work, every time you can change one person's life, you've got to find some kind of comfort and some kind of hope in the fact that, you know, for that one person or that one family, you know, life is marginally better and hopefully long-term better than others.
When you talk to people in the camps about what they're hoping for in their own country, is it regime change? Is that a realistic prospect?
Look, that's a brilliant question. And again, the best way I can answer it is that there is no conclusive answer to this. When I speak to people, it seems to change dramatically. And so we've got two sort of, well, we've got a scale or either end. And I've had people look at me and say, one of the questions I constantly ask families that I sit with is, you know, what do you want? Is it that you want to emigrate to the West? Do you want? And every time, like every time, not just sometimes, every time the answer is, we just want to go home. We just want to go home.
Yes.
And so my follow-up question to that is always, well, what does it look like to go home? Can you tell me what would a change be that would allow you to go home? Many of them tell me if Assad was no longer to be in government, then they would go home. And others tell me, well, no, if he remains, then it's slightly better, but we need to deal with ISIS. And so, again, it's this scale, and a question I'm asked constantly at the moment is the U.S. Action in Syria good, helpful, and will it solve things? And look, using that scale analogy, if you come in at one end of that, well, the other end is dissatisfied. If you come in the middle, you please no one. But the most complex thing is that none of these actions are conclusively good, bad, or indifferent, because for some people, depending their perspective, it's always going to be bad, and for others, it's always going to be good. It's such a difficult thing.
You've sat and prayed with people. You've sat and prayed and talked through issues with Muslims, for example. You're a Christian. How do those conversations go?
They're some of the most incredible and challenging conversations I've ever had. You know, coming from, again, this Australian culture where so often I'm, to be quite honest, I'm terrified of Muslims because of the stuff I see in the media. But time and time and time again, when I sit down with these people, they're some of the most loving, gentle and nice people I've ever met. I've prayed with them. I've heard stories about people who, in the middle of this, and this isn't just isolated stories, but there are countless people who, because they're seeing the actions of several groups that are portraying themselves as being based around Islam, are sending them on a search for God and for Jesus. You know, and we're seeing churches and droves of people. I mean, one church we're working with in this region, they have two morning services. The first is full of what we call Muslim background believers. Mm. And then the second is full of veiled women who are seeking Jesus. And the way they start that service is they say to them, okay, whose prayer was answered last week? Who would like to share that? And then hand after hand up goes up and there's testimony that follows. And then the way they end the service is they say, well, who's, and what are your prayer requests for next week? And, you know, on this most recent trip, and I'm still kind of outworking this thought in my mind, but Muslim and the people I met, the Muslims that I met, they have more expectation that Jesus will answer prayer than I do. And that is one of the most confronting thoughts that I've ever had, because they pray with this expectation. And when I thought about it, I looked back and said to myself, I can't even remember what I prayed for yesterday, let alone last week.
Yes.
But these people, they have this desperate desire. And remember, they're Muslim, Syrian refugees living in abject poverty. They're not praying for the new Apple Watch, or they're not praying for a blessing.
Yes.
They're praying for these deep spiritual things, saying, Jesus, make yourself real to me. And what we're seeing is that time after time again, Jesus is turning up and people are coming to find him. And it is just incredible.
So, Mike, you're saying that in the midst of all of this, non-Christians, people from an Islamic background, Muslims, are turning to Jesus, going to Christian worship services, praying to Jesus, and he's becoming known to them?
Absolutely. You know what the genesis of that is in so many ways, and it's what I love about our ministry, is that when the local church becomes the hand and feet of Christ,
yes,
we see people drawn to it. And one of the great stories I heard from my family was, we're a Muslim and we came here, but there are no Islamic organizations working in these camps providing help. Not one, they said. And we came and we found a church helping us. And when we went there, they didn't ask for anything. They served us no matter our race, our religion, or our gender. And they said, seeing the church help, they said they didn't try to sell it to us, they served us. And that is just seeing countless people say, hang on, I had this idea of Christians being this, but when I came here, you were this. And they, and the church we work with said, look, we will never make the gospel transactional. They said, we will start by giving them food and everything we can, and that's a relational thing.
Yes.
And then they said, that opens up the transformational, which is the gospel. And watching church...
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're saying is, and this is a really key point, you're saying that these churches, these Christian churches that are working there and organizations like your own, are not going in to proselytize, they're just going in to serve.
Absolutely, and that is one of the most beautiful things to see, because they serve, you know, they truly are the hands and feet of Christ, and they're saying, look, that will lead within Muslim culture to being invited into the house. And believe it or not, as much as we fear it, Muslims are open to speaking about Jesus, right? They are religious people, desperate God seekers, and by getting into the household and getting into the family through serving them with the bare essentials in life, some of the most incredible gospel conversations are arising, because people are saying, we came here and you served us. Why is that? And you say, because that's what Jesus would do.